Dana, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Safwat Nizal. Our executive directors, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Carl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeth, Emily Anderson, Dante Torrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. Also tune in for our special, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. special on Monday, Martin Luther King Day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world, serve its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up an ox, speak, grunt, no strength. The fury's beating down. Yo,
88.7 FM, WRHU, Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. 88.3 WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. And 89.5 FM, Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. You are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert in New York, and we are thrilled to be joined by our guest today, Dr. Catherine Rye Jewell, who is broadcasting from Massachusetts, right? Hi, Dr. Catherine. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Good. Thank you very much. Now, as we were talking before we got on the air, this show airs on several college stations and many community stations around the world. And you are the author of Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio, which we're going to talk about today. And once again, we thank you so much for coming on.
Great. Yeah, it's really cool that there is this worldwide reach of college radio. It's really interesting to see that model, and it's very exciting.
It is very exciting, and I do feel very fortunate to be a part of it. It's very good for me, and it was sort of in touch with the South African station every week at Bush Radio, our sister station, and it's a beautiful partnership to see. And at the end of last year, their GM wrote me a very nice note, oh, thank you for your hard work, and I just thought that was so cool that all across the world we're making this impact together.
Yeah, that's really nice. I mean, we tend to think of college radio as this hyper-local kind of media, but there's so much opportunity in being able to connect across stations.
It is, and it's a wonderful thing, and once again, I'm glad to be a part of it, and we're glad to have you on today. Now, you're here to discuss your book, Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Tell us what the book is about. I think you could tell it's about college radio, but get more into specifics if you could.
Sure. So I was a college DJ, and I'm a historian, and in 2011, my radio station was shut down. The FM signal was sold. This was 90.9 in Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. And so being a historian, I started asking questions about where did this thing of college radio even come from? Why are they closing our station? What do they see as having changed that they no longer need this FM signal? But where did this even come from to begin with? Why do we have this thing that we value so much that we had control over? And how did Vanderbilt in the beginning let us have access to the airwaves? So I started looking at archives to think about when did these stations come around. I really had no idea because I worked on policy history and political history and looking at regulations. I had a background in that, but I hadn't really looked in depth at radio. And I discovered this huge, just fascinating history at stations across the nation that channeled all of these different expectations for what the student experience should be, how universities should relate to the public, and what college radio's role in the music industry was, in culture, but also news, information, and community relations. And so it just became this ballooning subject that had so many amazing stories and controversies and scandals that I just dove in, and here I am, what is it now, 13, 14 years later, still writing about college radio in its many different forms. And so the book deals with college radio really since the late 1970s, when it became this really valued institution for students and community members to feel like they had a role in shaping popular music and popular culture. And that became this presiding reputation for college radio. But what I discovered is that college radio has meant many different types of things over the years. And so I'm currently working on research that looks back to the early days of radio and what it has meant across the 20th century.
So you're working on a part two of the book, shall we say?
Yes. I started writing when I first began writing the book, I thought it was going to be the whole history of college radio, but it was just too big. It's been so many different types of things over the years, over the century, and since the birth of radio itself as a technology, that the narratives just didn't fit into one overarching history. There is kind of an overarching regulatory story that the federal government and the way it regulates radio stations has been a key player, but I'm really much more interested in what's happening on the ground at these stations and how different institutions and communities respond to those regulatory changes. And there you find a lot more nuance in what's going on, that it's really a much more complicated, much more interesting story, I think, than what's kind of happening up at the, you know, in the halls of boards meeting and commissioners meeting about the future of radio. That when you look on the ground, that's really where things are happening, where college students are really innovating new ways of doing radio. And that's what I'm really interested in. And, you know, you can't really tell the story of what's going on in the 1940s with what's going on in the 1990s. So they're two very different contexts. And so the narratives of that didn't really fit together into one big volume. So that's why I'm going back and looking earlier in a different book.
So what was the process of putting this book together? Tell me what that was like. Because you said you had the idea when Vanderbilt shut down the station. Tell me how you decided we're going to make it late 1970s. How'd that work?
So one of the benefits of doing this type of history is I realized that when universities move their archives online, one of the first things that they tend to digitize is the student newspapers. So my first approach to this, to figure out what stations do I want to look at, was to just go around to different universities and search for the call letters in their student newspaper online archives. And I did that for probably 30 to 40 different universities. I would take, this is what I would do during my drinking my morning coffee. I would bring my coffee into my computer in my home office. And I would say, okay, well, let's just like look and see what's going on at Georgia State. And let's look at University of Pennsylvania. And I would put in my search terms and out would pop, you know, hundreds of results. And so I would just collect those and kind of get a sense of what was going on at different stations at different times. And I amassed this research base. And then from there, I would see if those stations had physical archival collections, which being at universities, again, there's the benefit that there's usually a library that is interested in the institution's own history and would collect records related to student activities or to community relations. And so, you know, so take Georgia State, for example. Not only do they have this really rich record of their student newspaper that I could access from my home office in Massachusetts, but then I could go to Atlanta and there in the archives was this amazing archive of the station going back to its debut in the early 1970s. And there were controversies about firing DJs and a station manager who wanted to take the station in a kind of a commercial rock direction against the wishes of DJs who were interested in new wave and punk in the late 1970s. And it ended up being this series of hearings in front of a review board and administrators got involved. And I have all of the handwritten notes and testimony about that. And you see these students who are just so passionate about what they felt the station should be and how it should best serve the students and their education, but also be a point of connection and a kind of cultural service for the city of Atlanta. And so I just repeated that at different stations and amassed this body of research, which I then had to put together into a narrative, which was its own kind of challenge. I often say that writing this book was like constructing a giant jigsaw puzzle because, you know, all the what's captured at these different stations, it varies over time. And, you know, sometimes they might have a lot in the 1970s and nothing in the 1990s. But then I had another station that had a lot in the 1990s. And so I had to kind of construct this narrative out of all of these different pieces made up from these local stations and what was happening. And then when you take a step back and you look at the national presence of college radio with publications like CMJ that were collating its charts, its influence on shows like 120 Minutes on MTV, then you can start to kind of get a sense of how all of those local developments were shaping this national reputation of college radio through the 80s and the 90s. So it was quite the process of putting it all together, but it was really fun because you get to delve in deep into these local controversies that really, I mean, people were really mad. They were very passionate. And so there's a lot of drama involved in some of these cases.
Well, that leads to my next question. Describe some of these cases and kind of the culture war, because it says when annotating your book online, there is this discussion of the culture wars and what college radio was kind of up against, which makes sense because when you're looking at the times of the 70s and the 90s and the 80s and kind of what was going on at that time historically, you can kind of understand like, oh, I could see like this whole we're not going to take it anymore, to quote the song, kind of ideology of the students. Tell us about what you found and what was really interesting to you with those culture wars.
Yeah, so the big cultural battle that's taking place is really a big political battle over culture involves regulation. And so the 1980s is the beginnings of media deregulation. And what this does is it leads to more consolidation and ownership of media. And this crowds out a lot of local forms of media and places for people to go and find points of connection and community. And so what happens is that a lot of those functions become the province of these college and community stations, which are volunteer run. They're much more locally oriented. They are interested in serving specific communities that may not have media service. The problem is that there's only 168 hours in a week. And some hours of the day are much more prized than others. I think maybe any alum of college radio may be familiar with when they first get a show, they might have to do the 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. slot because there's not as many people listening. And so that's where you put people who are learning so that they can figure out, you know, what they want to do and create something valuable. And so with college radio now serving more of those functions, educating students in how to do radio, providing community volunteers with access to the airwaves, serving these different musical genres, subgenres, and music scenes from noise music to jazz to folk to reggae to what we would think of now as world music is very popular on college stations. But also the rise of things like indie rock and hip hop, all of those things are looking to college radio for space on the airwaves. And so you get the clash of these different interests, all of which have value, but there's a limited amount of space because really until the early 2000s, we still exist in a world of media scarcity. Like sure, there's cable and that, and there's the rise of kind of fragmented media, which college radio is kind of part of that trend, but it's kind of the catch-all from things that are being pushed out of these larger commercial and corporate run media institutions. And so what I like to say is that college radio is really where ordinary Americans experience the culture wars in real tangible ways. That we have images of the culture wars of the 80s as like, you know, Tipper Gore and the PMRC putting parental labels, warning labels on albums, or Two Live Crew getting in trouble for obscenity in Broward County in Florida, and the kind of scrutiny on hip hop artists for you know, kind of their explicit images or hypersexualized lyrics or gangsta rap or something like that. But really the culture wars at its root is about whose voices are kind of allowed into the nation's cultural fabric. What does the sound of the nation come from? And that these stations are places where people are really trying to get their voices injected into that conversation. And it involves questions of policy and politics, to be sure, but it's really a kind of a local story as well.
Was there anything about some of these movements that surprised you, that really moved you in a weird way? Was there anything that really got you and you were like, wow?
Yes. I have one whole chapter that's dedicated to one story in particular, which happens at the University of California at Santa Barbara, which is about, happens in the mid-1980s. So it's in the wake of this PMRC moment where, you know, the Washington Wives have these very publicized hearings in Congress about the content of pop culture and popular music in particular. And, you know, artists like Prince and Madonna are kind of under scrutiny. And, you know, very famously, Dee Snider, you know, you mentioned the Twisted Sister lyric earlier. Dee Snider of Twisted Sister and Frank Zappa and John Denver appear in front of Congress to basically push back against this as a kind of censorship. But the PMRC continues its work. And so this would culminate, their actions would really culminate in those parental advisory stickers. But they also served as a resource for people who were dissatisfied with what was happening on radio. And in one of these instances, a local listener in Santa Barbara was really angry about what he heard on the college radio station in Santa Barbara. And so he goes to the PMRC for help to be like, I need this station to clean up its act. Tell me what I should do. And they help him file a complaint about one song in particular called Makin' Bacon by the Pork Dukes, which had all these double entendres. It was kind of raunchy, kind of punk song, very tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, kind of transgressive in its lyrics, let's just say. And he succeeds in getting the station reprimanded. And it was one of four cases that the FCC was considering that really amped up scrutiny on what was happening on college and commercial radio. So Howard Stern received a fine in the midst of all of this, although it was a station that actually syndicated Howard Stern. It wasn't his originating station. And then a Pacifica station was referred to the Justice Department for obscenity charges for one of its broadcasts. And I think what's interesting about this story is it shows how not only how college radio gets caught up in this culture war action, but it also speaks to the kind of difficulties that these stations were having. So in the aftermath of all of this, the Santa Barbara station it's trying to appeal to a wider audience because there's this sense that college students are kind of drifting away from radio. It's not necessarily serving their interests. And so they start experimenting with kind of talk radio formats. And this is actually the station where Sean Hannity, now, of course, of Fox News and syndicated AM radio, he's one of the kind of pioneering conservative talk radio hosts. He actually gets his start on the airwaves at that station. He actually gets fired from the station for some of his commentary. The station is forced to offer to rehire him, but then he moves on to commercial talk radio after that. So he doesn't actually come back to the station. But there's this kind of image of these culture war battles as being about the content, when really, when you look closely, it's about these questions of ownership and who does the station serve. And that listener, it was, you know, yes, he was offended by the content, but really he felt that the station was his and that he should have a say. And then the station, you know, was trying to broaden its appeal so that it could pay the bills. And that meant venturing out into different types of content than we usually associate with college radio, especially in the 1980s, as the kind of haven for punks and weirdos and all kind of alternative cultures of all different sorts. And so what I like about that episode is that it asks us to look beneath the controversy to really see the different interests that are involved and the way that the culture wars is about allocation of institutional resources as much as it is about the actual expression involved.
I think, at least from my experience, what you said was interesting is that we have in the mornings at WRHU, our campus station, we have a top 40 show, which is a format you see a lot on commercial radio across the country. In the evening, we have a classic rock show, which again is a format you see a lot. There's a country show, which is a format you see a lot. But there's also a very popular show that's alternative rock music, which is a lot of the music that gets talked about with your book, with R.E.M. and Nirvana. And I think that's interesting, kind of this experimental, like, oh, what is this sound? What is this sound? But it's something you're really only hearing on local college independent radio. And it's still something to this day that's exciting people. And I think that's kind of an interesting through line, your book in the 90s and 80s to modern day.
Yeah, and there you can really see that there is this long-standing role. So I'm assuming that a lot of the students who gravitate to maybe the classic rock show have an interest in doing commercial radio, right? That they are envisioning a career in audio production and engineering and doing the work of radio. And that these stations are serving that educational function as much as they're serving a cultural educational function of, say, ensuring that alternative artists who maybe aren't getting play on commercial radio stations have a place so that listeners can learn about new music. And so there you kind of see this divided purpose of what educational radio is, and that it can serve the commercial industry by educating people who are going to that, or educating people about music that may ultimately end up on commercial radio, at the same time as it is kind of breaking new ground and educating people about content. And so that's where, you know, the model of college radio, there's so much opportunity there because they can break with some of those commercial programming logics where they're not aiming for continuity in listenership across the entire day, but that instead they can break the day up into all of those different types of radio, and different listeners may tune in at different times because they don't have advertisers that they have to please. And that's really the fundamental difference in why educational radio is different and can do all of those experimental things and serve all of those different types of educational functions, even though it may actually sound really commercial in some cases.
We touched on my experience and what I've noticed and how it relates to your book. As a former college disc jockey yourself, a college radio DJ, what experiences of your own did you bring to the book as you were writing it, whether it's in the book or not, but as you were kind of going like, oh, this relates to my experience when I was at Vanderbilt, how did you bring that in?
Yeah, so I was not somebody who was really brought up in, so I did college radio in the late 1990s when it was really at the peak of this alternative identity sort of associated with indie rock in particular. It had been the place that incubated the success of bands like REM and Nirvana, to be sure. But by the 90s, we already had this thing of alternative radio, right? The corporate music industry was noticing what was happening and using college radio to draw talent and to have it be a kind of commercial radio format based on those sounds. And so college radio was really this, this is also, it relates to the regulatory story. This is after the Telecommunications Act of 1996. And so there was, when I was doing college radio, there was this real sense of antipathy towards the commercial radio industry, that it was an us versus them, the little guys, you know, the local community oriented small scenes. We were never going to be playing music that would air on the big commercial radio station. It was a real sense of conflict. And so I am, you know, I'm approaching this book at a station that has been sold. And so I'm really driven by this sense of college radio is something very different, very separate from what's happening outside of the left-hand side of the dial. But when I started doing the research, I realized that it was always much more intertwined with those questions than I thought, that was really much more up that image of college radio was much more a product of my specific experience in it, where I was never the DJ who was driven by, you know, I had friends who, you know, Jeremy Mills, if you're out there listening, he was the general manager. He was in my year, and you know, he was really interested in old school funk. And that was what drove him to do very specific forms of radio. And he was just delving into all of this music that served really as the raw material for hip hop and, you know, genres and underground hip hop in particular. And that was what he was focused on. I never really had that kind of specific genre focus. I was much more of an observer. And so I was interested in what all the other DJs were interested in. You know, what was the goth show playing? What was the industrial show playing? What was the African show playing? You know, what kind of reggae was intermixed on the indie rock show? And so I think I kind of brought that observer's perspective to doing this history, that I had to kind of let go of that confrontational image and really embrace that let's go out and explore all the different forms of college radio across the years that it has taken. So I think that's kind of how my personal experience, I think, ultimately ended up informing how I did the history. But, you know, I had to shed a lot to get to that point.
Just as a reminder, you are listening currently to the One Road Community Radio Show. on several college radio and community radio stations around the world, which is very exciting. And we're talking to Dr. Catherine Rye Jewell, who is the author of Live from the Underground, A History of College Radio. Going back to the topic of kind of regulation and kind of the FCC, like, at least in my experience, we have like an FCC kind of cheat sheet. If they come in during your salon, kind of this idea that there is something, not that we're kind of answering to, but that's kind of regulating what's going on. But what you were saying before about like double entendre, I think it still is interesting that even the big commercial artists, even for something that is considered like radio to be quote unquote a dead medium, they still release. I'm just going to use an example from my top 40 show experience. Sabrina Carpenter is a very popular singer right now. And you were talking before about double entendre. She's someone that uses a lot of double entendre, but she still releases kind of those clean versions of songs for the radio play, one would assume. I think it's interesting trends and ideas that were prominent back in the 90s of the artists of those times and are still in effect today with the popular artists that we're playing on college stations.
Yeah, and it goes back to that Santa Barbara moment when Howard Stern and Pacifica were also getting involved. If you actually look at the regulatory record, there are very, very few stations that ever lose their license or are fined because of obscenity or indecency. In fact, there's only one college radio station that ever lost its license due to obscenity, and that was the University of Pennsylvania station WXPN in the 1970s. And eventually they got it back and it became a much more professionally run station as a result that syndicates content that's distributed through National Public Radio, you know, those kind of aggregators. But really the point of that moment in the 1980s was to influence those stations to kind of self-regulate. There's this kind of weird, I guess, juxtaposition of two seemingly incompatible ideas. On the one hand, you have media deregulation in the 1980s of the FCC is going to let media corporations kind of do what they want, to own more stations. It's going to take a much more hands-off approach. At the same time as you have these culture war battles that are seeming to increase the pressure on stations to regulate content, that they have to toe a much narrower line in terms of what they're putting out there. So those two things kind of seem to be at odds, that, you know, a much more lax regulatory state and a more strong scrutiny of what's going on, where you're going to be in trouble. But really, so that moment of those fines and the reprimand kind of do the work of the regulatory state by forcing people to self-police. That, you know, when I was doing radio and or getting trained for radio in 1997, though the first quiz I had to take was the 7 words you can't say on the air. And to really be mindful that, oh, the FCC is out there, someone's listening, that there was this chilling effect that those decisions had that kind of forced local stations to mind their P's and Q's. So that's not to say that we weren't playing transgressive music, because, you know, as a 18-year-old, what I didn't understand was that there was no FCC censor sitting out there at the radio receiver listening for the 7 dirty words and then, you know, finding the station. That for that to happen, you have to have somebody call in and complain to the FCC, and then they launch an investigation, and then they decide. So it's actually this much more long drawn out process. And so the purpose of those regulatory decisions, you get a few people in trouble so that everybody else kind of minds themselves later. And I mean, I think what's interesting about that approach, though, is it kind of reaffirms the local standards that are used often in determining what is obscene or what is indecent. That, you know, so if you have a radio station in, you know, let's just say central Massachusetts, those listeners in central Massachusetts would have to decide that something is obscene and worth the FCC getting involved. And so the listeners in central Massachusetts might have different standards than in northern Michigan or in southern California. And so, you know, who's going to really make the effort, like that listener in Santa Barbara, to go and get a station in trouble is kind of where the rubber meets the road, I guess, in how the policing of content takes place. And so as culture changes, as certain types of listeners are tuning into certain stations, you know, the types of listeners who may be offended by what's happening in a Sabrina Carpenter song are likely not the people who are tuning into the station playing the Sabrina Carpenter song. So they're never going to hear it. They may hear their kid listening to it and then get mad. That's usually how these complaints happen. But we're so fragmented in our media landscape, and a lot of this stuff is happening over now streaming on the internet or, you know, YouTube or Spotify, that are not subject to FCC regulations in the same way that a terrestrial land-based signal is, that a lot of these questions are moot together. So then it just becomes about the content and not about the regulatory structures that govern the allocation of the nation's public airwaves.
It's interesting you said about that whole idea of a training quiz, because we have at Hofstra a training class where you learn about, you know, what you can and cannot do on the air, and you have to pass the test to be a member of the station, what's FCC approved, which we should also mention stands for the Federal Communications Commission, which controls basically what you can and cannot say on broadcast here in the United States. For our global listeners, we should mention that. But I'm curious in your research and what you have seen, because there was this idea, and there still is to this day, of what you can and can't say on air, this deregulation. College radio not necessarily has to sound a certain way and look a certain way, but if you're doing kind of block formats, which we have, I know a lot of other stations, it's more free form. But if you're, how would you say, with all this regulation, students to this day are still innovating and still being creative and having fun with the medium, despite all the guidelines that are put in place? Because it's much more, the rules I feel are much more conservative now than they used to be, from what I've heard from alumni who were in college radio in the 70s. And
yeah, I mean, and certainly before that moment where indecency became something that was being policed more, or at least encouraged to be self-regulated. You know, I think we also forget sometimes that the FCC it's not just interested in content. And actually, for a long time, the FCC didn't want to have anything to do with content, that it kind of had to be dragged kicking and screaming into looking at the content of stations. But really, the FCC is much more busy making sure that radio stations don't interfere with each other, that more stations get in trouble with the FCC for not maintaining their logs than they do for the songs that go out over the airwaves. So, you know, it's about making sure that your tower's not blasting out a signal, you know, at a much higher wattage than it should be, and then interfering with other stations. Or, you know, maybe if you're assigned 90.9 FM, but then like it kind of accidentally strays over to 91.3 or something like that, like that's, you know, those are the kinds of things that the FCC is also interested in, and maintain those technical standards. And, you know, so that's much more likely where stations are going to encounter the FCC rather than in something that they play. But at the same time, I think the latitude in college radio really comes from what you mentioned in that block formatting, that you assign a DJ a certain block of time. So my show tended to be Tuesdays from 4 to 6 p.m. or from 6 to 8 p.m. And so during my 2-hour block, I could do whatever I want. So I could have that specific focus show on a genre like Jeremy Mills did with his funk show, or I could program it pretty free form. You know, so the difference between free form and other types of formats is, so free form is anything goes, that you can literally play whatever you want, that you can mix genres, you can hyper focus on a type of genre, and there are really no rules for what you do in your block. A lot of college stations actually do have more rules, so they're not strictly freeform. So Vanderbilt's station, you know, had a kind of freeform, free-flowing identity in that we were broadcasting shows across all different types of genres. And so unless you were a specialty show, though, like, so say the goth show, they could break the quote-unquote format. But in my show, because I didn't have a specific focus, I could play whatever I want. But once an hour, I had to play a jazz cut, and I had to play a world cut. And then I also had to play, I think it was a black dot is how we formatted it, which are basically new releases. And so in my program log, I would have to go in and indicate where I played those certain requirements. So maybe out of a total, you know, 2-hour show, maybe 6 songs were derived from that format. Some stations, so say like Georgia State Station, they had heavy, medium, and light rotation, which is much more like a commercial format, but they still kind of had a kind of freeform ethos to them, even though they had this much more structured format. And so there's this kind of sliding scale of across all of these different college radio stations in terms of how much formatting or how much control there was. And I think that's really where the variety and excitement of college radio comes from, because it's a lot of times it's students just figuring out like, hey, how should our station be formatted? What kind of rules should we put in place? People pushing back on that, community DJs pushing back on that. And that's really where you get these substantial conversations over what culture should look like and what popular music should be featured on the radio. And I think that's really where the excitement is.
And I think there's also an excitement about, we turned out this before the air, our chief engineer, Dr. Andy Gladding, who is a Hofstra Radio alumni, was on a family vacation in South Africa. And to my knowledge, he walked into Bush Radio. He'd met with the people at Bush Radio, our sister station that broadcast this in South Africa, and was like, hey, we should do a show together. And Andy ran the show for a while. And then he had another project come up, and he came to me, a 19-year-old student at the time. And he was like, you should run this show. And it's interesting because this is kind of like what the best of what college radio is. And I'm so glad you're here to talk about college radio, because I think this show is very professionally sounding. We're having a nice conversation and a nice interview. But it's also an incredibly innovative and creative thing to do, because you're going to be airing in Ireland, you're going to be in South Africa, in California, all across New York State. And so there's that level of it too. It's innovative, it's creative, it's professional sounding, it's very clean in my viewpoint. I'm very proud of that. But the other thing is that you talk about this in your book. Who allowed me at 19 years old to do this, to kind of run this ship kind of the way that I did? It's kind of astonishing that they let us get away with it and do it for so long, which is something you kind of mentioned in your book about college radio.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, it's really remarkable. And a lot of that comes out of the moment when college radio stations were emerging on FM. So it happens in the 1960s and the 1970s. FM is becoming much more viable as a medium. More consumers have access to FM receivers. They're cheaper. And FM, as you all probably know, sounds a lot better than AM, right? It's a lot more fun to listen to music and especially to spoken content on FM. And so, you know, it had been kind of the province of audiophiles before that it had been around since the 1940s. But it was really much more for, you know, classical music enthusiasts who also probably had a kind of class status that enabled them to have access to the expensive FM receiver. And by the late 1960s, FM is becoming democratized. It's much more accessible. And that's the moment, though, when you also have a student movement that is demanding more autonomy for students. And there had been, so the precursor of FM on college campuses is something called carrier current. And these were radio stations that were literally carried by the physical infrastructure of campus. So if you lived on campus at Hofstra, for example, and you lived in a dorm, the radio station would hook a transmitter up to the steam pipes or electrical wires, which then would throw out for about 200 feet an AM signal. So if you sat your AM receiver next to the radiator in your room, you could pick up the carrier current, which is probably broadcasting from a dorm basement nearby. And so it's literally only available to people on campus. And there's a ton of these across college radio stations starting in the mid-1930s. The first of these is at Brown University. It started in 1936. Students then kind of carve out this tradition of doing radio for themselves. It's a student activity. A lot of times they're paying their own way, either through a student activity fee or a lot of these stations would sell advertising. And so they had this tradition of being independent from the university. But this is so this FM moment happens at a moment where universities are much more interested in having a public presence and in reaching out beyond their walls to kind of show that they have this value. And you have more students who are living off campus, because this is an era of massive expansion in enrollment where not every student could live on campus. They just simply didn't have the physical capacity to house them. And so if you have a snow day, for example, it's much easier to have a FM radio station that can reach students off campus to let them know about that news, but then also to maybe play steady music for them at night. So we as student DJs really owe our existence on the airwaves to that particular moment where there's this kind of confluence of factors that shape this idea that students should have radio that serves them, by them, and for them. But then that kind of opens up all of these different opportunities of bringing in community DJs, of doing these different types of radio. Some are very explicitly linked to academic study through, you know, radio, television, and motion picture departments or schools of journalism, where they offer a kind of pedagogical laboratory in addition to performing this campus and public service. So there's kind of a confluence of all of these different factors that explains a lot of the range that we see in these types of stations. You know, there's some radio stations or some colleges that never actually get an FM station. UCLA, for example, which you would think, like, huge university, metropolitan area like Los Angeles, of course, would have, you know, a high-powered, prominent station. It is carrier current, and actually a pretty bad carrier current. The technology is not that great through the 1990s, and then they go online. So there's all sorts of forms and permutations of the technology, but also the types of radio.
It really is astonishing how much information you know about this. And I'm not trying to say that to blow smoke in any way. But when you're going back into, like, all these different stations and you're just reciting it off the top of your head, it's really impressive. I'm curious, though, as a historian, as a professor of history, how does kind of the research that you would do on, like, American politics or the presidency or some of those things that you're interested in, how do you kind of use those research skills and tie it into the work you did on college radio? Is there overlap that you found in the research that you've done on those topics?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, methodologically, you know, certainly there's this toolkit that historians have in the way that they go about answering their questions. And, you know, that's really rooted to these archival practices and to how we contextualize what we are seeing, how we look to the stories of individual people or groups of people or places to give us the depth and the dimension of these broader thematic developments in, you know, across historical eras. And really at the heart, we're storytellers. That's what we like to do. I mean, it's right there kind of in the name historian, is that we are telling stories about change over time through the lived human experience. And people are messy. And so, you know, one of the things you have to do as a historian is, you know, really think about individuals' motivations and what is shaping, you know, particular places, but then also how they fit into these broader trends. And so I, as a historian with a training in political history, you know, I'm really interested in how people outside of the halls of Congress or political parties are experiencing political and policy transformation. So my first book actually looked at Southern industrialists in the New Deal. It seems very, very different than radio. And it certainly was from, you know, I had to learn all about the technology of radio and, you know, the regulations that were shaping it. But really, I was still interested in the same kinds of things that I, for those industrialists, I wanted to know how they interpreted the New Deal kind of on the ground in their factories and in their political organizing at a moment where they felt very disempowered. And, you know, and they're kind of a bunch of odious characters, you know, segregationists and anti-labor, you know, kind of advocates and trampling on environment and all these things that, you know, are not necessarily kind of savory characters. They're very different than, say, college DJs of the 1980s. But structurally speaking, right, they're both people who kind of existed outside of regular political processes, but who nonetheless found ways to participate in them. And so that's who I am as a historian, what I'm interested in.
And something you noted, I forget, there was an article you were in about this book, and you said, and it's even on your LinkedIn too, that if you knew, if there were anybody out there who had stories of college radio, to send them to you as you were putting together this book, and you were saying the response to the book, because you're doing history that a lot of people live through. It's modern history. What were some interesting stories that people sent you, and what's some interesting responses that you got from former college radio folk?
Yeah, I mean, this is...
They're very passionate. They're very passionate.
Very passionate. And this was really scary to do as a historian. You know, my first book was about the 1930s. So the people I was writing about were not around. And now all of a sudden I'm writing about this thing that, yeah, it's important to me, but like I'm just one person. But, you know, I was very cognizant that I was telling the stories of people who really valued that experience. And you know, and sometimes I was very cautious because, you know, when we're young, we tend to do and say things that we might not look back on fondly as adults. And so, you know, I was trying to be very careful with how I characterize some of the moments that, you know, produced a lot of controversy and a lot of these kind of heated conversations. And actually, so my most valuable feedback that I got was, so in the opening story of the introduction, there's this moment at the University of Chicago where basically a DJ plays this song that's kind of, you know, has some transgressive content, and they get hauled in front of city council and dressed down for this content. And there's the DJ is, you know, so the University of Chicago sits in the South Side. And so their range reaches the South Side of Chicago, which is, you know, an under-resourced community, doesn't have a lot of media coverage, African-American community members that are kind of often at odds with the university, right? There's this kind of tense town and gown relationships there. And, you know, somebody charges this DJ with sounding like, you know, basically like a white kid who is trying to tell the Black community what they should hear and what they should listen to and how they should appreciate music. This was this really tense moment. And I couldn't find the original DJ. I couldn't find his name. And he actually found the book, read it, and emailed me. And was like, I was that DJ. And he's like, and you captured it exactly right. You know, that he found himself, like he understood the, you know, this is a song that had lots of double entendres. And, you know, he sort of understood the meaning of it, but that he found himself kind of caught up in all of these complicated city and cultural politics at a moment of really high tension. This was in 1994, kind of at the peak of some of these culture war battles over hip hop and Black music and politics. And he was like, you know, you absolutely got it right. And everybody kind of had their voice heard. You know, there was conflict. There were different perspectives at work. But I tried to really value the perspective that everybody brought to that conflict and to try to, you know, show that scenario through those different images without demonizing or picking good guys and bad guys.
That's amazing that he found you.
Yeah, I was so nervous when I got that email. I was like, oh God. But
right.
It turned out okay.
Well, it's something that's interesting in that this is something that means a lot to a lot of people. Like, I think because I'm a senior and I'm heading out of this phase of my life, and I'm saying, I think this is the time that I spent at RHU is something that's going to stick with me for a very long time. And I still remember we were, Hofstra was on a trip in the city, and I met an on-air personality at iHeart named Maria Melito. She's on the air at the New York Rock Station. And what she said to me, and I told her I was a college radio student, the first thing she asked me, she said, what time are you on? I still listen to college radio. And just kind of the lasting impact that it really has had on all these people, some of the moments of controversy, some of the joyful moments. I think it all kind of does blend together. And like you were saying, a historian, a storyteller, some of these things that we get into are messy, but there is something really quite nice about the whole thing when you really look at it, the experience of being a part of a college station.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to that idea of educational radio, and that we attach so much meaning and value to this experience because, you know, in many ways, even if it is a pedagogical laboratory to like learn knowledge-y skills that go into programming radio, it's still an extension of that kind of liberal arts basis of the university experience, and that we carve out these experiences for people who want to engage in a larger act of self-discovery and finding your voice and whatever that means, and to kind of chart a new course in your life, whether, you know, you're an 18 to 22 year old having, you know, your first time away from home, or you're a non-traditional student coming back, or a community DJ, you know, who's trying to find a place to have a voice, that it's all part of this broader educational purpose of radio. And I think that's why it's so valued by its participants and its listeners.
And we were talking again before you got on the air that you kind of encourage all of your students, whether they're, I would assume it's whether they're communications based or not, to join the campus station.
Yeah, I even offer an extra credit sometimes at the end of the semester that students can get a bump on their grade if they go and do a radio show. And literally, I don't care what they do. Like, they can get on the air and talk about Tom Brady and their deep love of Tom Brady for 2 hours. Like, it's fine. It's just about, you know, looking at that microphone and not knowing necessarily who you're talking to. And that potential for connection, I think, is so valuable as an experience for any college student, no matter what your major is. You know, you could go in and talk about, you know, your English literature research paper. You know, we'll talk about Proust. It's college radio. Why not?
All right. We're getting down to the end of it here, but I've asked you a ton of questions this whole hour. I'll ask you maybe the most sentimental one now, because you were saying what your students and you encourage them to do it. We've talked about what college radio means to all kinds of people through the book, and I've talked about my own experience. What does college radio mean to you, Kate?
Oh, it means so many things. But for me, I think it does come back to that central identity as educational radio. I see educational radio as different than public radio. It's certainly different than commercial radio. And I think it's education for other people to expose them to sounds that they might not hear otherwise, but it's also education for the self. It's a really formative way of doing radio that creates lasting meaning, even beyond the 2 hours a week that we might have to go out and explore whatever genre it is that brings us to radio to begin with.
Well, on that note, thank you so much for coming on today, Kate. We really do appreciate you here at One World Radio. And you're the author of Life from the Underground. If people would like to read Life from the Underground, where can they go?
Any retailer will have it. It's from the University of North Carolina Press. And find it wherever books are sold.
And on that note, we thank you very much for coming on our show today. You've been listening to the One World Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU, Radio Hofstra University, 88.3, WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM, Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town. Thank you.
by the fire.
Pretty little